Soul Talk is a podcast dedicated to making space for Latinx storytellers and content creators across all media to chat about their art, experiences, and culture. As a branch of the Soul Project, Soul Talk welcomes you to the Green Room.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Soul Talk. My name is Joey Reyes. I'm the producing assistant with the Soul Project. Today, we have a very special episode. We have some pre-recorded conversations that David and I had together, one with Stephanie Ibarra, the newly appointed artistic director of Baltimore Center Stage, and Maria Goyanes, the newly appointed artistic director of Woolly Mammoth Theater in D.C. They were recorded at separate times, and we are compiled them here together for a special episode. We wanted to talk about just the new leadership appointments and what they've been experiencing, what they're anticipating for the future of their organizations, their respective organizations, and how that transition has been going. So I hope you are in for like a nice long commute. It is going to be a little bit of a longer episode, but there's so much beautiful wisdom just spilling out of these two incredible leaders. And we hope you enjoy. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Joey.
How are you doing today?
Actually, it's a little bit of a whirlwind for me at the moment. My managing director is going to Center Theater Group in LA.
That's right, Megan.
She shattered the glass ceiling over there.
Yes.
Megan Pressman, and is going to be the managing director over there. She's going from Woolly Mammoth, which is a $5 million theater, to CTG, which is a $50 million theater. So that's a big leap, and very, very exciting. And bittersweet for me, right? So at the moment, her last day in the office was this week on Tuesday. We had a really wonderful happy hour. We have a big going away thing that we're planning for next week. And we're in the search process for a new partner for me. So at the moment, I've got a lot of people reporting to me and a lot of stuff happening. But you know what? I actually feel pretty excited about the opportunity to find somebody to create a big long-term vision with. In the United States, we often don't have the managing director and the artistic director change over around the same time. Mm-hmm. But in the UK, that's like standard practice. And I always sort of envied that in the UK, because then like two people can like hit the ground running and learn together what they want, how they want to sort of change a culture in an organization, rather than sometimes there's that push-pull with folks who had been there before, you know, in that way. Not that I felt that push-pull with Megan. We had a great partnership, but I'm excited about the opportunity of being able to work with somebody who's almost as new as I am.
Yeah.
and coming to D.C. and thinking about Woolly Mammoth in relationship to not just D.C., but also hopefully nationally in the world.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's really exciting.
That's a long answer to how are you, but that's how I am. I'm thinking about a lot.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things I think that's really exciting about that moment, as you were saying, is the turnover happening almost simultaneously. And, you know, one thing that we're hearing so much about in the field is the artistic director turnover. I feel like those are getting announced, and we're really getting a lot of coverage and not hearing as much necessarily in the managing executive directors. And one thing, I mean, I'd love to hear you talk more about what it is you specifically look for or might be looking for in a partner, in that kind of partnership, and talking to our listeners a little bit more about what that relationship is between an artistic director and a managing director in terms of leadership.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a really great question. Well, I just want to be upfront and give you the caveat that I'm 9 months into being an artistic director. So I'm very much learning what it means to be an artistic director at the moment. And that's not to say that I don't have a lot of experience and haven't done parts of this job already for many, many years in my wearing different hats for different organizations from 13P to the public. But learning how to do it all in that everything that job entails is pretty new for me. So when I think about a partner, I think about wanting or needing someone who from the very get-go we can have a baseline of trust with each other, because I'm looking for my person, you know what I mean, mm-hmm. who is going to be able to you know, when we are faced with the inevitable challenges and I think opportunities that come up that you're faced with when you're running a nonprofit arts organization, that we can actually band together and show a united front, be a united front, but then also out of the public eye, really be rigorous with each other about and having that kind of productive conflict of where we want the theater to go and how do we get it to reach its highest potential. And my sense is that the best way to do that is not with a relationship where you're always agreeable mm-hmm. and respectful mm-hmm. always to the, you know, to the sort of like obviously respectful to each other, really important, but what I'm talking about is more like too respectful or too careful right. to the sort of norms of the job or that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. that I do want to have a partner who's going to be able to say like, you know, that play was really tough and this is what happened. And we made that decision together, but this is the consequence of that decision. So let's have that discussion. Mm-hmm. I want to have that discussion. I don't necessarily want somebody to be like, that's not my lane. I want to talk to them about it. I really want to have a deep collaboration. And so I think that's a little bit different from the way that managing directors and artistic directors have been even trained up
right.
in, through now, is that I feel like a lot of people are like, that's my lane, this is your lane, I don't touch what you do, you don't touch what I do, and you know, we find places where we come together. But to me, the exciting part of Woolly Mammoth is like, we don't have to do things the way that the rest of the theater does them
right.
because we aim to be as innovative a theater company as possible. We are an incubator, not just of new plays, but I hope new forms and mm-hmm. new ideas mm-hmm. for the theater. And I think that the best way to do that is to actually have the fullest collaboration possible where you understand, you know, the ways that my producerial skills overlap with the managing directors and their producerial skills overlap with me. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And I would love to be able to have a partnership where we are building on that together rather than compartmentalizing each other's jobs.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
So it makes for harder conversations. It'll make for harder conversations potentially, right? It'll mm-hmm. make for like, oh, maybe you stepped on my toes there. But that's where I was saying that the trust, if the trust is there from the get-go, I will not feel that way, right? Mm-hmm. If the trust is there, I know that we're both on the same page about what it is that we want for our partnership and for the theater company. And yeah. then I will always assume good intentions in that regard.
Right? Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Because we'll be working towards a common goal. So I think that that's actually, to me, when we talk about like this new wave of artistic directors, et cetera, it's like a lot of them have come from, either being number two positions, done a lot of producing within their organizations, mm-hmm. or are even self-identified as producer types, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like myself. And I think what that means is that I hope that we can think abundantly and that those characteristics and those traits come fusing with other traits and characteristics of a managing director that may overlap or may not overlap can only be a good thing.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, the you're talking about people coming from like more producerial backgrounds. And I'm thinking about the article that came out in American Theater just a little over 2 months ago that was titled What Does a Producer Do? Where you and Stephanie Ibarra and Jacob Padrone and Stephanie Rowland, amazing people, were being asked this question, what does a producer do? And I'm just going to repeat a quote that you have here in this article that I really enjoyed. And speaking to, you know, of shared values when looking for partners, and have you just speak to that a little bit. You said, the values are in your budget. How you spend money reflects who you are and the kind of work you want to do. Being able to understand how those resources are allocated and how to marshal those resources is another key aspect to the role. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, you know, it's really I've been thinking a lot about how much we're paying actors and our artists. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when I look at the budgets and I see that it's incredibly difficult for an actor to make, you know, even if they work at really, really prestigious, well, you know, well-regarded theater companies, it's really hard for an actor who is continually working to even break $40,000 a year. Mm-hmm. I look to that and say our industry's values on artists are not aligned with what we talk about. And that's an industry-wide issue, I think. And so what I mean in terms of the budget, when you look at the budget, you can see people's values. Mm-hmm. You can just look how much we're paying artists,
right.
You know, as opposed to how much we're paying, you know, the how many people on the admin staff, sometimes production staff, certainly on certainly consultants that we bring in, right. are comfortably living a middle class life or an upper middle class life, and are our artists, particularly actors, able to do the same in our industry. Mm-hmm. Right now, I don't think the answer is in our favor. It's not very good. Mm-hmm. And so that to me is reflecting a problem, a disconnect between the values of what we say our industry, our, you know, what our industry values, what our field values, and what we actually do. But you can look at, like, you know, gosh, Stephanie and I talk about this a lot. It's like if you put only the artists of color on the smaller spaces, that actually mm-hmm. has an economic impact on them. They get paid less
yeah.
than the artists in bigger spaces, right?
Yep.
That is like, you know, talk about an equity issue, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
To me, you know, and so when you look at an organization's budget, you can really see like how much are they spending on what, mm-hmm. who's getting paid, where is the money going, and it's super not easy. I mean, now that a lot of theaters own buildings, do capital campaigns, have to upgrade those buildings, etc. There's definitely a lot on the facilities and operations front that can really suck a budget dry. There's no question about it. But I still wonder whether or not there's like a major paradigm shift that has to happen in the field where we can actually all say, even though Actors Equity and the union say it's okay to pay this, do we feel like as an industry, do we feel like that is the ethical thing to do when someone can't even, like, frankly, $40,000 for a couple in New York City that might have a child or not is below poverty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like the below the poverty line.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I think that there are major big values that have to sort of get surfaced through that. And I think budgets are a way to do that. And I mm-hmm. feel like artistic directors have talked about that before, but I do feel like this wave of producers or artistic directors who have producing experience and know how to read the P&L and understand what it means and how that reflects the values of an organization, mm-hmm. I hope that we can actually disrupt some of that stuff and dismantle yeah. some of that stuff in the future.
No, that sounds amazing. I mean, that sounds amazing. And I think, you know, one of the things that's really exciting about your appointment was also coming from the public. And then before that, coming from 13P and having had such extensive experience in producing in a variety of different models and then going into a traditional sort of regional theater house that has a lot of promise in terms of the experimental and exciting work that it's been doing. What do you think in your experience of the different kinds of models that you have worked in has prepared you the strongest for your vision of what you see leading this theater into the new American theater? Does that make sense?
Oh, what a great question. This is such a big question. I'm not going to be able to pick just one thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's no world that I could just pick one thing. There's no silver bullet in that. I mean, that artist-centered focus mm-hmm. to me was cemented in my time at 13P, mm-hmm. no question, because the model there was – every playwright was the artistic director of their show. Mm-hmm. And what that meant was that if the playwright wanted to be involved in the press releases and the marketing blasts and the collateral, great, awesome. If they didn't, no problem. The staff could do it. But you get veto power if you're the artistic director. And then picking who it is that you get to work with and, you know, really leading the company. There's an emotional support part of that, too, mm-hmm. that comes with being an artistic director that those playwrights had to play, you know? Mm-hmm. And I learned that watching them do that, too. So I loved that because I felt like by learning how to give artists some room, which was basically even just at the heart of the company, it was, you know, whatever the artist was working on at the time that their slot came up was usually their 13P show.
Right.
So it's not product oriented, right? It's very much about where are you in your lifespan as an artist and what you're thinking about, what are you working on, and the moment that 13P comes calling because your slot is coming up, and what do you care about doing at that time? And so, you know, for someone like Sarah Rule, it ended up being revisiting an old play of hers and making it into a musical.
Right.
That's what she wanted to do at that time, you know? For Young Jean Lee, it ended up being her actually being in the show and dealing with the death of her father through
yeah.
that. Mm. We're gonna die,
yeah.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of that really was kind of it was an amazing experience to sort of learn how to live in the uncertainty, you know, and sort of let it be and let it come, let it emerge. Right. So that's me calling in to the space, Adrian Marie Brown,
yes.
and Emerging Strategy. It was an amazing thing to let it emerge
right.
organically. Mm-hmm. And it was an amazing thing to learn how to, at a pretty young age for me. I started with 13P when I was, you know, 23.
Mm-hmm.
Was to learn how to make space for artists to actually let that and trust them that it will emerge.
Mm-hmm.
And then the thing that I so that's that I'm taking with me for
right,
the
absolutely.
Rest of my life, and
mm-hmm.
I'm bringing that to Woolly Mammoth, no question. But then the other thing I would say is that I never thought I'd work in any other theater but the public theater. Frankly, I thought that if I was going to move on from the public theater, it would be, I don't know, given the diplomacy skills, like I would go disaster relief or, you know, work for the State Department
right.
or, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like be one of those people that you call in when there's an earthquake and like help everybody. You know
absolutely.
What I mean? Like I just thought like I had so many different because you're dealing with so many different kinds of personalities and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I just like you. I learned over that time just to how to work with so many different kinds of people, right?
Yeah.
And still make something happen. But the reason why I didn't really feel like I was going to work at any other theater was because I so felt my values felt so aligned with the social mission of the public, right? Mm. That the founding of the place for free Shakespeare in the Park, access for all, that our lives are enriched by theater and that our citizenry, you know, is activated mm-hmm. by the performing arts and the theater because of the content that we're watching. I mean, just like thinking about the different plays and the from Joe Papp to George to even Joanne Acolytis
right.
and then Oscar, finally, just like always thinking about what is happening in the world and trying to reflect that in some way, shape, or form on the stage so that we can actually come face to face with that kind of reflection and really sort of have the conversations that we need to have. Like that still feels incredibly powerful to me.
Right.
So I feel like I've been able to find and land in a theater company that is also built on not just aesthetic innovation and making room for artists,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, is totally Woolly Mammoth, and because of the kinds of risks that it takes with artists, you know, and in terms of the work and the kinds of work that we do, but that also has a social mission. That is, Howard Chalowitz, who founded Woolly Mammoth, always was asking himself, why the theater? Why is it important now? Why do we need to make the case for the theater now? And what is it doing to actually enrich the lives of the people who come in who come in contact with it, from mm-hmm. the artists to the audiences? And I felt like he constantly was asking himself that and thinking that through and doubling down on what that meant and mm-hmm. why Woolly needed to exist. And he chose with his co-founders the nation's capital for a theater that was an alternative to the mainstream. And it's not a coincidence that it's been able to thrive in right. Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. Because for me, Washington, D.C. is a place of speaking truth to power and exercising our rights as citizens. Mm-hmm. And so I knew Washington, D.C. before I even got this job, because how many times have I been to the Marriage Equality March, like, you know, I protested the Iraq War, like, you know, you name it.
Right.
I came down and made my voice heard. And so I think it's a really powerful thing to have a place in a city that is symbolic in our country, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. And is the seat, the bedrock of our democracy, which, you know, right now is going through some real turmoil.
Absolutely.
It feels really important to be at a place where we can actually speak truth to power, mm-hmm. so close to where it is that the laws are actually being created and made. Mm-hmm. And so I feel really good about that. I feel really, really like I've lucked out. I have the opportunity of a lifetime to be at a place that does both the thing that I cared about most at 13P, in that aesthetic innovation and space for artists, and then also have a social mission, which is the thing that I cared the most about, being at the Public.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, as a sort of follow-up question to that, and maybe a wrapping-up question, you know, going into your first inaugural season, which I think, you know, at the time when y'all announced it, everyone went wild. It was such an exciting season. But, you know, programming
And you all are in it.
I know. I'm a little biased.
it's amazing. I mean, are you kidding? The fact that the What to Send Up When It Goes Down tour is launching in Washington, D.C., I also feel like is just like a dream come true. It's a show that needs to be seen, I think, all around the country, and mm-hmm. I hope to help you and the Movement Theater and Alicia and Whitney make that happen. So it's a great honor to bring it here.
Yeah, and I guess my question then is, you know, going into your first programming season, knowing it's going into an election year in the nation's capital, you know, what were you thinking going in, knowing this is the first season? I'm assuming that was something that was in your mind as you were programming it. But what was your goal with this first season that you planned?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, the rubber will hit the road with me in terms of the election in Washington, D.C. in 2020, mm-hmm. because my understanding is, I've just gotten some anecdotal evidence, is that in both 2012 and 2016, people didn't go to the theater here.
Right.
Busy campaigning, et cetera, those kinds of things. So some of the best work that Woolly's done, some of great, great work, wasn't as well attended as other times in the year. So I've been thinking about and wanting to think about fall 2020, which is one of the most important elections of my lifetime.
Right.
What is the right thing to do in a place like Washington, D.C. in terms of the theater? Mm-hmm. And my gut is to go hyper-local.
Yeah.
My gut is that this is not a moment where we put, you know, the over politics on the stage with content that is so on the nose. My gut is that we actually have to reach out to the people who are in Washington, D.C., who live here year-round, regardless of the election cycle.
Right.
And there are 800,000 of them here almost. And it's one of the cities in the United States that's growing and will continue to be growing, certainly is projected to over our lifetime. And my hope is, and my feeling is, that a lot of the folks who are here in Washington, D.C., who make their lives here, who are not necessarily connected to the administration, don't actually know who Woolly Mammoth is, which was surprising to me. And I think that that's because it's just about life cycles and growth of organization, you know, that I followed a founder who'd been here for 38 years. And those 38 years were brilliant, amazing years. But certainly towards the end of those, he knew he was leaving, and it was about stability and sort of connected to Woolly Mammoth, and not necessarily yet about looking outward again and thinking about growth and thinking about meaning more to more people in this city. Mm-hmm. Because he was, they were prepping for the new artistic director.
Right.
So now I'm here, and now that's what I got to do. So the reason why I bring that up in terms of the fall of 2020 and that election year is what I feel like, just to bring up what to send up when it goes down, is a perfect opportunity to actually extend beyond the Woolly walls and bring the show in partnership with some really key stakeholders in this city, who Woolly has partnered with before in the past, in the case of Howard University, and who Woolly wants to actually start a relationship with over a long period of time, which is the ARC performing, you know, it's a huge campus in Anacostia.
Yeah.
And so by bringing, those are just two of the sites that we're going to go and then bring it back to Woolly, is just starting to seed in the 1920 season a more local strategy, a hyper-local strategy for the 2021 season.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm thinking about in terms of the election and being in the city, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I'm thinking about is in terms of the content, what is the stuff that I really care about and want to be talking about with folks? And, you know, there's almost nothing higher on my agenda than anti-racism,
right,
particularly in a city that is still quite segregated, was a majority black city up until recently. And I'm not sure. So I want to talk about that. I want to contend with that a little bit. And mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of really amazing writing speaking to that.
Yeah.
So it felt really important to be able to start my first season off with the things that I cared the most about, that I wanted us to be talking about. And the combination to me of Fairview and what to send up when it goes down felt like the exact right thing to do.
Yeah.
It felt like if I did Fairview on its own, and not what to send up, that the Woolly Mammoth, which to me is still a predominantly white institution, would not be actually answering the call that is in Fairview.
Mm-hmm.
And so for those of you who don't know Fairview, one of the things that I feel like that play is about is how do white folks make space for stories, and even just for the presence,
right,
of folks of color. And I felt like that challenge, that question at the heart of that play of where does that happen? We had to, Woolly Mammoth as a theater company had to answer that call.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I was like, we have to do what to send up when it goes down and make space, give a platform to not just artists of color who are making the work and creating the work, but also a producing company who had the wherewithal, creativity, the forethought, and the gumption to make this happen, which is why it was like, I'm not doing my own production of what to send up. I got to bring the movement's production of what to send up, because that's what it means for a predominantly white institution to make space for folks of color.
Yes. Amen.
And I can't wait to come down and see it.
Amen to that.
Yeah. Thank you. And I hope that's something that can be a model, right?
Absolutely.
You know, I think that sometimes these predominantly white institutions think that, like, it's enough to say, well, we're going to do the black play by the black writer with a black director, right? And there's a major difference from actually saying, no, we're going to take the moment and actually, in addition to all the work that we're doing in the season, we're going to actually make visible and give a platform to a theater company made up of folks of color,
right,
who are producers, mm-hmm, and making
have been
the work.
Doing the work. Yeah.
That feels really worth it to me and really important.
Yeah.
Amazing.
We're very grateful for the opportunity to share our story.
Oh my gosh, please. I'm the one who's grateful. Do not believe it. I didn't make the show. Yeah. I get to reap the benefits of your amazing, amazing work and let more people get to see it. Yeah. So it's like, you don't have to thank me.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I know how busy you must be, but thank you so much for taking the time to sit and talk with us. I really appreciate it.
I'm so happy to, and would be excited to do it again and again and again, which I know we will for the rest of our lives.
Absolutely.
As long as we're in the theater.
Always and forever.
Thank you for doing this, and thank you for making it available for folks. I think that's a big deal.
Thank you so much again, Maria.
Thank you. Thank you, my friends. Take care. Good luck with everything.
Thank you, you too. We'll talk soon.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Pretty good. Helping fun.
Thanks for calling in. Talking about leadership and the leadership change that's going on across the American theater. And I think for the Latinx community, we're really excited to have three new artistic directors and a new associate artistic director also, Amelia Costa-Powell, who's just announced at The Rep, which is such an exciting times. And, you know, the episode that we did last episode was talking about Latinx futurity and this idea of the future. And so as we continue that conversation and we're looking at this conversation on leadership and the future, we'd love to chat with you and talk to you about, well, what does leadership mean to you, especially as a Latinx woman?
Ooh, it's a big question. I think the answer to that question evolves, like, you know, as I learn more about myself and the world and as I get older. But I think it's interesting because I feel like being a leader is not separate from the way I think about being an artistic producer, which is that my job largely is to help facilitate and create the conditions for other folks to do their best work and to sort of march toward a collective vision, whether that's a vision for an organization or an art form or a field or a society or a play.
I love that. I love that. And you just announced an incredible season, your incredible first season. It's so exciting. And I think it just sort of proved to so many people the idea that it is possible. You know, we hear so often these conversations of like, well, you know, we're looking for the best and we're looking for this. And I think with the announcement of your season, Woolly Mammoth, you know, Hannah's season at The Rep, you know, all of these seasons around the country, we're really seeing some exciting new work burgeoning, some new artists that are coming. And so I think that idea of creating the space for artists to do their best work as a definition of leadership is just really exciting.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate the kind words. It's, on my best days, I feel so proud and grateful and just so thrilled to be walking this journey with colleagues like Mitaki and Hannah and Jacob and Maria and others. And on my more cynical days, I'm like, see, it's not that hard. Mm-hmm. You just make different decisions.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the experience of being offered the position and
applying.
And applying and you know, how long was that process? And then if you can elaborate like on the transition from your previous position at the Public Theater and then going off into over to Baltimore.
Sure. Well, you know, I had been at the public for almost 7 years and occupied many different spaces inside of the artistic office, and that place, as it is wont to do, it alters your DNA. So it's interesting to me, just as a mental exercise, to think about whether or not, like, what kind of artistic leader I would have been at the beginning of my time at the Public versus the end of my time. And I'm really great. I tend to think like, oh yeah, I like this version of me way better than the alternative. And I think that has so much to do with, learning how important the conviction of your values is. And and really having the time and space to understand how to leverage creative resources and financial resources on behalf of artistic adventures. And I wasn't really looking to leave the public. That is the public, because of its size and scope and because of my relationship with the artistic director, Oscar Eustace, you know, I felt constantly challenged in all the best ways. And like I was constantly growing as a person and as an artist and as a leader. So when Baltimore Center Stage called and said, "Are you interested? Will you come talk to us?" They were about halfway through a year-long process. Wow. And they were going through themselves. And I, you know, originally I was sort of like, sure, you don't turn down a conversation. Mm-hmm. You always have a conversation. But I didn't have any preconceived notions about, oh, yes, I really want this, or, oh, no, I didn't really want this. I just felt open to having a conversation. And the more conversations I had, the more confident I felt in my ability to be able to show up as myself in this institution. And that was in large part thanks to some really great advice that Kwame Kwayarma gave me when I called him and I said, like, hey, he's the former artistic director at Baltimore Center Stage. And I said, hey, they called me. And do you have any advice for me? And he said, please be yourself. No matter what, do not try to be who you think they want you to be. Just show up as you. Mm. It's the only way you're going to know if they want you and if you want them. Mm. And so throughout the process, that's what I did. Every conversation I had, I showed up as my authentic self. And I said words like, phrases like anti-racism and white supremacy and oppression and systemic exclusion and civic engagement and, you know, civic responsibility and new work and community engagement and social accountability. I was saying all of those phrases over and over again throughout the process in order to say, you know, like, this is me. Mm. This is who you get. And to my utter delight and surprise, they wanted me anyway.
Wow. That's exciting.
So the morning I got the call, the chair of the board, Terry Morgenthaler, called me. I had just gotten out of the shower, and so I was like still in a robe, and I was like, she offered me the job and I just started shaking. I had this visceral response. Like, I just got this huge shot of adrenaline, and it's how I knew that I needed to take the job. My body was telling me, literally, I got a jolt of excitement. And then we were off to the races. And the transition has been hellacious and totally life-giving all at the same time. Mm-hmm. But the one way that it is, the transition has never let me down, is that I have continued to be able to show up in my own skin, and I've been welcomed and celebrated and appreciated for it. And that's been huge.
That's amazing. I mean, I think it's amazing to find an institution whose values align with your own personal values. And I think, you know, when you talk about showing up as yourself fully, one thing that I think we don't hear about, or we don't talk about enough as people of color taking on leadership positions, is the power and strength of being able to show up as yourself, mm-hmm. and what it takes. Because I think for so many people of color, we are, given the sort of racist society that we live in, we do build an almost underdog mentality. And I guess for me, the question that I'd love to ask you is, do you think that you had an underdog mentality at any time? And at what point were you able to begin the work to build yourself out of that, to get to that place where you can show up as your full self?
Yeah, that's a great, great, great question. I had never really thought about that. I think that there is, the way I'm walking around in this world now, I feel like I'm not unique in that. I feel simultaneously, constantly aware of the systems around me that would have me fail and that would be obstructive to my path, whatever my path is. And both as a woman, as a woman of color, as a young-ish woman, there are just myriad ways, like explicit and implicit ways, that society is not constructed for me and to help me succeed. And yet, so I understand that the system is working against me at every time, all given times. However, I think I've never quite felt like I would like to believe that I've not internalized the underdog, that fighting that has been my sort of saving grace, like understanding objectively that there are systems operating, being able to diagnose that without sort of feeling or emotion, just understand it as fact and then proceed, has been the only way that I can think that I've escaped some sort of long-standing underdog mentality or defeatist mentality. This is not to say that those moments don't creep in. Like, for sure, everybody has moments of self-doubt and deceit and darkness, but I feel really lucky that for whatever reason, I have walked around and moved through life just assuming that that if somebody didn't recognize my wonderfulness, it was because, not because I didn't have it, it's because they couldn't see it. And that was on them.
That's power.
I'm wondering if you can talk to, I was reading an article that came out recently, I believe it was through American Theater Magazine, talking about what is the role of the producer, and there were some insights there, talking about, you know, with a lot of the artistic change, the people who are stepping into these leadership roles, including yourself, are people with producing, heavy producing backgrounds. I was just wondering, like, if you can elaborate more on that, and maybe like even your experience, your education, and how you feel like that's going to fuel the future of storytelling. Whereas in the past, a lot of artistic directors came up initially as directors or maybe writers, and not necessarily had the background or training of logistics and operations.
Yeah. Well, what I think is fascinating is that, you know, Jacob, Maria, and I get appointed as artistic directors, and all of a sudden there's this huge shift. There's perception that there's a huge shift toward producers. And remember, we are three people. It's the sort of same dynamic of like, oh, look at all of these people of color. And I'm like, y'all. Check out that pie chart, because it is still looking not cute.
Yeah.
But you know, I do think that institutional producing experience has become more and more valuable, whether or not that institutional producing experience comes wrapped up in a director, a practicing director like Hannah Sharif or Nataki Garrett, or if it comes wrapped up in the form of a playwright like Che Yu, or a designer like Chris Acebo. All of those artists have the producing chops that that Maria and Jacob and I have. We just came to it a different way. But it's the same skill set. And I think what's wonderful about this moment of ascending into or stepping into a formal artistic leadership role alongside Jacob and Maria is the validation that we're artists the whole time. The we could have a whole other podcast about the number of times that particularly Jacob and I were told that we didn't count as artists or that we weren't enough to be artistic directors and that we were administrative, even though he has his roots in directing and I have my roots in acting and the artistic motor is still very much alive in both of us. So my sort of take on this inclusion of artistic producers in artistic director roles is simply, yeah, it's about time. Yeah. And I would never define by somebody's artistic discipline alone whether or not they are fit to run a theater. But that is what has been happening for decades now. So this to me is just the tiniest step forward into broader inclusion in who is leading our institutions.
Yeah. I think it's really important that you uplift that the role of a producer is an artistic role, and I think, there was a time where the idea of like a creative producer was a little more popular, and now we're starting to see that resurgence, especially amongst, collaborative organizations and groups, this idea of there is the role of the producer is an equal and as important collaborator as any other artist working in the field and on a project, and having that in leadership and having that sort of artistic visionary at the same time as a sort of logistic putting of a puzzle together mind actually makes for a really fantastic leader.
Definitely, something that keeps sticking out to me is the idea of just having a very strong and specific point of view, and just in particular, like, why are we gathering people together? What is our shared vision of bringing, a certain amount of people into a room and witnessing the story that's being told? And I think that's very creative, and especially when you start talking about audience engagement, like, well, how do you curate that experience for them in order to really envision themselves in this story and immerse themselves into it and feel like when they're coming to this space that it's like it is their second home, and it's a community that they're living within, and they can look forward to seeing someone there that night and, have a drink and a snack or whatever, and then go see the show and then talk about it afterwards.
I think that's right. And I think that, the thing about being an artistic director, the idea of artistic directors being producers definitely did not start with Jacob, Maria, and Stephanie. Like, that is the job of an artistic director. It always has been. they have to be producers to some degree, to varying degrees, but there's no version of an artistic director's job, and there never has been, that didn't require some amount of understanding of the business and the logistics and how things come together and the impact it's going to have on a community or an audience.
One of the things here at the Soul Project, just to shift gears a little bit, that we're obviously very excited about and interested is the continued uplifting and affirming of our Latinx artists and voices. And I think one of the things that was very exciting when we saw your season announcement was how many Latinx artists you had in your season. And I think that coupled with the reality that we continue, unfortunately, to see so few of our artists working across the stages and our stories on stages, I guess my question, and sort of two-part, is why do you think that we continue to see so few of our stories on stages? And what do you think as a community we can do to ensure that more of our voices are heard?
Well, I think the reason that we continue to not see our stories represented as widely as we should, the very basic answer is systemic exclusion and bigotry and racism. I also think that that there is a really deep-seated and complicated history of white supremacy just embedded in our field, and how we meet a play and an artist where they are, how we evaluate the quote-unquote success of the piece. I think that is also standing in our way in terms of really getting to a place where we can be multifaceted and more sophisticated in our understanding of how stories get told. And I do think that, you know, for me personally, I love being in the room with artists of color, and I feel so at home with Latinx artists, even as our experiences are as divergent and diverse as any community. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if, as a community, we can do a better job of amplifying all of the ways that Latinx stories show up on stage, and all of the ways that Latinx artists can animate different stories. Mm-hmm. I think that there's something in the ghettoizing of artists of color that is inhibiting us all. You know, next season, the fact that I just am thrilled to be producing Noah Diaz's play, Richard and Jane and Dick and Sally. And one of the things I love most about the play is that here's a Latinx artist who has written this stunning play that is not overtly about, in air quotes, a singular Latinx experience. Mm. But instead, it holds the Latinx experience. It holds the Black experience. It is this little microcosm, I think, of any given family culture. And it's weirdly like, it's not culturally specific. It's not supposed to be. And yet it is the place that I myself, as a Latinx, half Mexi, half Chexi person, see myself the most. Mm. That's my family on stage.
Beautiful. Thank you for that. I know that we don't have you for much longer. So in light of time, I was wondering if, just for some final thoughts, if there's any advice or words of encouragement that we can put out, that you specifically would like to put out into the world for anyone who's interested in pursuing arts administration and producing and really, you know, honing in the craft of the creative producer.
Yeah, I would say that every producer, their currency is relationships. It's not actually money. It's like how other sorts of resources. The biggest currency I have as a producer are my relationships with artists and other theater makers. And that moves mountains, sometimes more than money, often more than money. So I would say to anybody looking to facilitate creative processes, whether it's strictly through administrative work or through creative producing or whatever, that you must mind your relationships and never take them for granted, and be kind, and because you never know. You just never know. Mm. So be kind.
Lovely. Yeah, I love that you elaborate on the fact that of relationships and people. I always think it's really funny how people focus so much on currency and in regards to talking about business practices, but you know, those practices can't exist without clientele.
Mm-hmm. Gratitude and grace go a long way.
Amen.
And on that note, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us, and we were very much looking forward to being able to experience your first season.
I really appreciate it. I can't wait to see you both in person. Yeah. I hope.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Stephanie.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Thank you all for joining us for today's episode. Make sure you follow Soul Project on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. On Instagram and Twitter, we are at Soul Project NYC and The Soul Project on Facebook. Our website is www.soulproject.org.